This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. You would think that when someone who has consistently polled as one of the most popular governors in the country says this about a candidate.
I'm going to spend a lot of time, and I have spent a lot of time, supporting and working with Anthony. I think he's probably the most qualified person who's run to be auditor in a long time.
You would think the state party for that candidate would then do everything it could to elevate said candidate. But
Donald Trump has become a litmus test for Republican candidates. So much so to the point that many people who describe themselves as Trump supporters won't support me and would rather blank the ballot and have a Democrat.
Okay, so that's Anthony Amore, and he is the moderate Republican running for state auditor against Democrat Diana DeSaglio. By the polls, Amore is the Republican candidate with the best chance to win a statewide office, and he's the only candidate that Republican Governor Charlie Baker has endorsed. And yet, you won't find him listed on the state party's website. In our latest From the Newsroom, we wanted to dig into why that is and what it means for the state when one of two major political parties grapples so deeply with its identity. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks has been reporting on this. He joins us now along with former head of the Massachusetts Republican Party, Jennifer Nasur. Anthony, welcome.
Hey, good to be here.
And Jennifer, great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
So, Anthony, I'm going to start with you because we used a couple of pieces of the sound right there at the top from a story that you filed today on this situation with Anthony Amore. You talked with him about his standing, you know, such as it is within his own party. How is that sitting with him?
Well, you know, you could describe Amore as sort of, you know, the loneliest Republican in Massachusetts right now because he's running as a moderate in a party dominated by pro-Trump conservatives. As an example, he stands alone as the only statewide Republican candidate who called for Trump's impeachment after the January 6th insurrection. In terms of where he stands politically, he's very familiar to a lot of Massachusetts voters. I mean, his stances are. He's fiscally conservative, but socially liberal. And that used to define the state GOP. People like Baker, William Weld, and others in the party. Paul Cellucci. You could go on and on. But today, many in the party, because of this rightward swing in the age of Trump, refer to Amore and Governor Charlie Baker as rhinos, that is, Republican in name only. And Baker, you know, who has ducked much of the political fray this year, hasn't even endorsed Jeff Deal, the Republican running to replace him, or any other statewide Republican candidate except, as you mentioned, Anthony Amore. So that's where he stands right now in this race for auditor.
So turning now to you, Jennifer Nasur, and you're the person to ask this question to as a former state party chair. Last week, members of the state party committee wrote directly to the national party chair, to Ronna McDaniel, for help. And that letter begins, quote, "We, the undersigned of the Massachusetts Republican State Committee, beseech you to use your office to intervene with Chairman Jim Lyons and his efforts to defeat our leading Republican candidate for statewide office, Anthony Amore," end quote. So that is an accusation that the party chair is trying to defeat one of the party's candidates. Have you ever seen anything like this before?
Nope, I have not. I mean, I know when I was party chair, we had folks running. We had Christy Myhos running in a primary against Charlie Baker. We had there was a gentleman who was primarying our auditor candidate at the time, Mary Z. Conadin. We supported every candidate up through the primary and then supported our candidates after. You don't talk bad about your candidates. You bring everyone together and you try to unify the party. A couple of things here, you know, statistically that we should put out there. The Massachusetts Republican Party that we're discussing here, the number of registered voters, not the party. The party apparatus is separate than the wonderful voters out there. 9.7% of voters are registered as Republicans. About 56% of voters are registered as independents. The rest are Democrats. If we are focusing here on a fiscally responsible candidate running for the office of the chief watchdog, fiscal watchdog, over all the agencies and all over all of the branches of government, wouldn't we want someone who is fiscally responsible, right? Now, you take that kind of 66% of voters, and you put out there Anthony Amore. He is a winning candidate. the Massachusetts Republican Party that calls the governor, who is leaving office with a gigantic surplus for the citizens of Massachusetts, a rhino, a Republican in name only, now calls everyone from me to former Governor Jane Swift, to our former governors, to anyone that doesn't agree with them, not 80% like Reagan said, not 70%, 110% they want. They call a Republican in name only. However, that same group of people, which is led by Jim Lyons, is actually doing and implementing exactly that concept of being a Republican name only, because he is supporting the Democratic candidate for auditor by his actions of not supporting Anthony Amore.
So let's bring you back in. And two things. Anthony, I'm going to turn to you. I want to note we've invited Jim Lyons any number of times over the last few years onto the show. He has not taken us up on our request. We would welcome Lyons to join us here and have a conversation. Anthony Brooks, I'll turn back to you to do two things. One, remind us of Anthony Amore, the Republican candidate for auditor's credentials, and pick up the thread where we just left it with Jennifer Nasur.
Well, a couple of things. In terms of his credentials, Anthony Amore is a private investigator. He runs security right now at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. We should note that he took over that job after the big historical heist of paintings there, and he's closely involved with law enforcement to try to retrieve those paintings. He also helped lead the effort to revamp security at Logan Airport after 9/11. So he's pretty highly credentialed. In terms of Jim Lyons, I understand he's not been on Radio Boston. I talk to Jim Lyons pretty regularly about this situation. And here's what he says. He's going to make the case, and he does make the case, and he made the case to me that he supports all of the candidates, including Anthony Amore. Anthony Amore would push back and say he doesn't feel the love from the Republican Party, that he's not getting the kind of support that he would like. He talks to people like John McDonald, who is a veteran and a lead organizer within the Republican Party in terms of reaching out to veterans. And, McDonald is urging Republicans to leave the ballot blank under state auditor or else write in somebody else, but not to vote for Amore. And that's one of the things that a lot of the committee members are upset about and wrote to Rona McDaniels about. When I asked Jim Lyons why there's no photograph of Anthony Amore on the GOP website, he says simply because Anthony Amore didn't send me the kind of photo that I wanted. Anthony Amore wanted to be pictured with Charlie Baker. We have that picture on our website. And Jim Lyons said this election isn't about Charlie Baker, and Charlie Baker hasn't endorsed any of our other candidates, and we don't want a picture of Charlie Baker and Anthony Amore. We just wanted Anthony Amore. Anthony Amore refused to send a picture of just him. And so this squabble sort of ended up with Anthony Amore not on the website at all. But it's indicative of this larger rift in the Republican Party that Jennifer Nasur was talking about very eloquently.
So, Jennifer, what do we lose when rifts like this? So we are about a month away from an election. These are statewide offices. The Republicans have lost representation in the state house. And statewide office. What do we lose as a democracy, party aside?
Yeah, look, for anyone, I don't care whether you're on the left or you're on the right, but if you consider yourself an American, if you are concerned about democracy, if you came here from another country looking for a better life, you came here for the democracy that America gives you. And that is a healthy and thriving two-party system. You get to pick and choose who the elected people are. Those elected officials work for you with our taxpayer dollars. That is our representative government, and that is what we all enjoy. When one party is so dysfunctional, and by the way, you're talking about 9.7% registered voters in the Republican Party, and it is this dysfunctional, it is really unfortunate for all voters, because even if you are a Democrat, you still want conversations to happen. You still want there to be good, healthy, civil debate. And we are not getting that here. And I think it's laughable what Anthony just said, that Jim Lyon said this election isn't about Charlie Baker. It's also not about Donald Trump. It's about the candidates in Massachusetts who are going to fulfill the needs and wants and desires of the voters in Massachusetts in 2022. And so, no, it isn't about Baker, and it is definitely not about Trump. But Charlie Baker is our current governor. And like you started off the segment saying, he continuously polls as the most popular governor. And if the chairman of the Republican Party actually was doing his job, he would want the person who is best suited for the position to be out there and vying for the position. He would put his support behind him. He would be talking about the issues. He'd be talking about the character. He'd be talking about the amazing resume that Anthony Brooks just read about Anthony Amore. And none of that is happening. And that is because he has this axe to grind against Baker and against anyone that is not a purist in line with Jim Lyons.
So we're talking about the struggle inside the state GOP, the latest front of which is Anthony Amore's candidacy as the Republican candidate for auditor. You've just heard from Jennifer Nasur, their former head of the Massachusetts Republican Party and host of the podcast Political Contessa. We also have WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks here. Anthony, Jennifer made the point that Donald Trump isn't running in the state of Massachusetts. You followed Anthony Amore and saw an interesting interaction between him and a Republican voter that raises the presence of Trump in this race. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Trump is present in this race. There's no question about it. I mean, Jim Lyons can say this election isn't about Trump, but it's all about Trump in many ways. So I caught up with Anthony Amore in Leominster last weekend at basically a fall festival where there was things like cotton candy and apple crumble and politics. And Amore was looking for support. And one guy came up to him, and the first question he said is, are you a MAGA Republican? In other words, are you a Make America Great Donald Trump Republican? And Anthony Amore said, no, I'm not. I'm a Republican. I don't support Donald Trump. And the guy refused to shake his hand and pretty much walked away. And that's not unusual. I mean, Amore said that same day or the day before he received hate mail referring to him as rhino scum because Charlie Baker made him his only endorsement. So that's what Amore is facing. But it also has to be said that this isn't just about Jim Lyons. This is about a large group within the state GOP. I mean, Anthony Amore would argue that there are lots of Republicans who support him, and that's probably true. But it is also true that the state GOP right now is dominated by pro-Trump Republicans. I mean, they're the ones, and that is the reason why people like Jim Lyons are, you know, throwing their weight behind Trump.
So that gives me a chance to then ask a broader question, but we'll keep it rooted here in Massachusetts. General Furlow, I'll start with you. We just saw Italy elect the most far-right prime minister since Mussolini. It's a trend we've seen across Europe, Sweden, Poland, Hungary. Often candidates who associate themselves with Donald Trump. We just heard, sort of model themselves. We've just heard Anthony Brooks talk about this thing he witnessed in Leominster. Are we seeing a nationalization or internationalization of our local politics here?
Maybe. And it's unfortunate because, again, you know, I think what happens, this is something that really bothers me in primary elections. It is we pick the person in the primary who gets the most clicks on Twitter instead of picking the person who can actually win in a general election. So, for example, in this case, with Anthony Amore getting so much hate from Jim Lyons and the other 37 people, by the way, I just want to point out the Massachusetts State Republican Party, right, the actual committee, has 80 men and women, so 40 of each. Currently stands at 74. That is because Jim Lyons has refused to seat some members that disagree with him and has refused to hold elections for other new committee members. So he is bringing down those numbers purposefully to suit his own needs. That's number one. Okay, number two, 37 of those folks are, you know, super Trumpy, whatever you want to call it, right? I don't believe in looking in the rearview mirror. I think we need to look forward. And so I think what's happening, too, is, you know, Anthony doesn't even need to pay attention to those people. He should go out. He is running to be the auditor of everyone in Massachusetts, not just the Republicans, not just the unenrolled, but the Democrats, too. Everyone who wants to see someone who's keeping an eye over our fiscal house. And I think that he is exactly the person overall. What is happening, though, nationally is that this whole Trump pull needs to go away because we are not helping democracy. Because on both sides of the aisle now, we have candidates that are so polarized that they never want to work with anyone across the aisle. That is very bad for every single citizen in every state and across the country. If we do not have representatives who want to work together to find solutions to bring us forward.
Last word to you, Anthony Brooks.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, I agree with what Jennifer says. You know, it's interesting. I mean, I'll leave discussions about parallels with Italy and the rise of Giorgia Meloni for another hour. But there's no question that, you know, Trump is nationalizing a lot of the debates at the local level. Anthony Amore makes a pretty compelling argument that as Democrats hope to sweep all of the state's constitutional offices in November, you know, all of the congressional seats, and hold on to supermajorities on Beacon Hill, he's holding himself out to be this one moderate Republican who can serve as sort of a check and a balance in the same way that moderate governors like Charlie Baker have served a check and a balance on the legislature. So that's a pretty interesting argument that he's trying to make. It flies in the face right now of the sort of Jim Lyons pro-Trump wing of the party, however.
All right, WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks there, and we've also had Jennifer Nasur, former head of the Massachusetts Republican Party, and also founder and president of the Pocketbook Project. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I want you to picture this. You're driving out on the Cape, Route 6, past shops selling beach gear and lobster restaurants. The trees are getting shorter and stubbier. The ground gets sandier. That salty smell gets stronger as you go along. And you turn onto a sand track and you see it. It's a shack, and I mean a little shack, in the middle of the dunes. The Provincetown dune shacks are unusual buildings, and they have these amazing histories. But as you can imagine, a little shack in the dunes, they're kind of falling apart, and repairing them is both important and a little different than repairing a regular building. We want to talk about that and why it's important to repair and maintain this piece of our hidden history. So we have two guests. First, Nat Bull, who has been rebuilding one dune shack in particular. Nat, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
It's great to have you. And Julie Schechter, who's founder of the nonprofit Peaked Hill Trust, which manages five of the dune shacks. Julie, welcome.
Thank you for asking us.
So, Julie, just pick a shack, one that you can picture in your head right now, one of the five, and paint it for us a little bit. What's it look like?
For the most part, they are quite worn. Even after 1 year, you put fresh shingles on a shack, after 1 year, they start to look quite worn and old. They're, for the most part, single-room buildings. There's an outhouse. There's a pump down the hill for your fresh water. There might be a two-burner gas grill in the shack. And they're quite isolated. Sometimes you might be able to see another shack from where you are, but often you can't.
How did they get there?
They got there various ways. Way back when the Coast Guard used to be called the Life-Saving Service, the people who walked to the beach to look for shipwrecks some of these lifesavers would ask whether, you know, going back into town was a bit of a hike, so they would build a small building.
So they could use as their outpost.
They could use, and they could ask their wives or their girlfriends, because they were all men, to come and stay out there. And so it was a way of not being out isolated, but to have somebody there. Well, sometimes the wives and girlfriends were not interested in staying there. So they started to rent them out to artists who were starting to come to Provincetown at that time.
So let's go into a shack, Nat. And we're in a studio. I want to smell it. I want to feel it. I want to know, you know, what's it made of and does it creak and how tight? Can you touch the two walls when you stand in the middle?
Well, they're not quite that small. But my first time out there, a good friend kept saying, you've got to come out. You've got to come out. And a couple of years went by and I never did. And finally, on a Friday in the fall, we went out and they were cooking a turkey in the oven because it was close to Thanksgiving. And you walk in and it's just antique wood everywhere you look. And the pulleys that operate the windows with their counterweights, everything is interesting. You look around at it and you're like, wow, who ever did this? And everything is cobbed together out of found wood, driftwood, and other things recovered from shacks that may have fallen down in the past or the old Coast Guard boat stations where the whalemen kept their boats. Those shacks were falling down out there. So people are always salvaging lumber. So you're not looking at anything very new.
So we're talking with Nat Bull, who's a shack captain with Peaked Hill Trust and is doing repairs on a shack. And we've got Julie Schechter here, founder and former president of Peaked Hill Trust. We're talking about these roughly 19 shacks right down in the dunes in Provincetown. Julie, this is a piece of our artistic history. Is this part of the reason you wanted to preserve these shacks, because they've been home and inspiration for so much art?
Yes and no. The reason I wanted to preserve the shacks was because people loved them. And the art was an important aspect, but not the critical aspect as far as I was concerned. But at that time, the only way for the shacks to be preserved, they were slated for being bulldozed, was to discover or assert historical relevance. So that's we did some research. It had, some of it had already been done, and discovered that they had been used by a wide number of and variety of artists over the years. There were composers, there were visual artists, there were writers, there were people with cameras. That, you know, there were just all kinds of work,
like a Jackson Pollock or a Tennessee Williams or
exactly.
an E.E. Cummings.
Yes.
So why do people love them so much, Julie?
I think they love them now for the same reason they loved them then. And that's because they touch something in the creative soul of people. So just as some of those famous people, famous now, were finding inspiration or something that touched them out in the dunes in these shacks, so too can people today who are not yet known. So the artists that we will know in another 10 or 20 years, and some that we know today, can come out and feel that sense of not just solitude, but inspiration and beauty and whatever it is that touches a creative person.
So, Nat, you're a carpenter by trade.
And a teacher.
And a teacher. So, in fact, you taught the carpentry trades.
Well, I taught shop. I'm retired now.
Yeah.
And I worked at Barnstable for 15 years, and I worked at Provincetown for 15 years.
What made you want to volunteer? So we have this system, essentially, where shack captains, where somebody volunteers to kind of be in charge of a shack. Now, I understand, interestingly, the shack you're a captain for is not the one that you're doing some renovation on.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
But what made you want to give of your time and your skills that way?
Well, it's kind of rewarding. I mean, to go out and find something that's in such need of repair, and the repair is constant, because if you go out there in the spring and look at a shack that's just gotten through the winter, you'll see how the sandblasting is incredible, and the sand comes in everywhere, and they develop leaks, and the critters want to get in. So the upkeep it's big, it's huge. There's an awful lot of work that has to be done yearly. And when I first got my opportunity to go out there, they needed somebody, and it felt good to help.
Where does it challenge you the most with your skills?
Well, I mean, we've got a team of volunteers, so it's not just about me. There's a list of people that work with me when we do these shacks. And I'm using skills that I was using in the early 80s when pneumatic guns and things were not used to the extent that they are.
Those are those nail guns that go...
Exactly, the pneumatic nail guns and power saws and generators and all that. So when we go out to the dunes, it's kind of like a throwback to that era, which was pre-automation, which is rewarding as well, because you're off the grid out there, so there's no electricity. So we're putting things together and taking them apart and fixing them the old way with manpower, because we don't have machines. And it's rewarding in that respect.
So how many hours do you think you spend in a year working on preserving these shacks?
Oh, my gosh. I used to try and keep a record, but I lost the record book and gave up. It's probably 200 hours at least.
So, Julie, one of the things that came to mind as I was learning about these, right, and looking at some of the pictures, and it's, I don't know how to explain it, because to see one, a photo of one of these shacks is to be both see something that you might imagine in Appalachia, and that you also might imagine in one of those paintings of a sweet little Cape Cod dwelling that you find in a gallery in the Cape, right, and some combination of those things. But one of the things that strikes me about this is property, right? We're talking about, in some strange way, oceanfront property where that is a privilege to have access to. But this exists in this nonprofit shared space. So talk about that a little bit.
One of the reasons that the shacks still exist, and I speak of all of the properties out there, not just the ones that Peekit Hill manages, is because there's a constituency. And it was clear to me as a founder that this was not going to succeed unless we ask a whole lot of people to come together and join in supporting the notion of the shacks. And a lot of people who have absolutely zero interest in staying in a place with no electricity or running water supported this because they thought that it was a good idea. And so one of the things that Peekit Hill does is to serve as a reservoir, if you will, of the Dune Shacks constituency. Because otherwise, it's a group of people who use them themselves, single families. And we know that unless there's a fair amount of money behind you, as a single family really doesn't hold a lot of sway. So that's what the organization does. It serves to support the notion of using these properties and using them in a way that's traditional. And if Peekit Hill was a for-profit organization, the cost of running these places would be exorbitant and they would only be open to well-to-do people.
Have either of you ever stayed in one overnight?
Oh, yes.
All right, so
every opportunity.
All right. So what's it like in the middle of the night?
It can be scary. We were out there through a hurricane, and the first 3 or 4 hours, you're like, oh, this isn't so bad. But then it just continues to blow, and the shacks will quiver in the wind. So it's a little frightening. They don't fall apart. They're put together well enough so that you don't have to worry. But it's a unique experience to weather a big storm in one of these shacks.
Does it feel, I'm projecting here, so I imagine being in this one of these shacks with the weight of the history behind it, right? The mundane but wonderful history of something like a Coast Guard person, or as I understand it, sometimes early on they were used, people would be shipwrecked, they would crawl to shore, they would need shelter overnight before they could get into the town and they could stay in one of those. I almost can imagine the whispers of those voices, Nat. And we're speaking with Nat Bull and Julie Schechter here about these dune shacks in the Provincetown area. Do you get that sense of the souls that come before you?
The first thing that comes to mind when I think of these shacks is stepping outside in the brightest, clearest, sunny day of the year. And I refer to it as big sky country because in my home where I live, there's trees all around. And I don't get that. But when you're in a dune shack, the sun comes up, and you see it come up, and when the sun sets, you see it set, and the sun is up for the entire period that it's daylight hours. So you have this sense of light, just pure light out there, and I love to be out there over the longest day of the year. That's my goal, is to pick that week and be out there.
And be out there, see all that sun.
And it's a retreat, so there's no interruptions, there's just you and your whatever you're doing. You have your books and your guitar and your painting or doing photography, and it is a retreat. And that's what's, I'm not hearing the whispering of souls, but I do adore the place and love it.
How about you?
There is a story, and I can't confirm its accuracy, of one particularly awful shipwreck. And the bodies were taken in from the shipwreck and stacked in Thalassa. And I do know people who will not stay in that particular shack because they can feel the weight of those poor dead souls.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a common occurrence for the other shacks, but what you do share with other people who've come before you is people will do small repairs, and you get to see what spoke to people about what the shack needed, And I think of it as giving a little bit of love to the shack.
All right. That is Julie Schechter, who is founder of Peaked Hill Trust, which manages five of these dune shacks in the Provincetown and Truro area. Also with us, Nat Bull, builder for the Thalassa Dune Shack, the one you were just talking about, Julie, and also a captain, a shack captain. Thanks to both of you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
It's great to have you. It's Monday, which means we take the time to check in on Boston sports teams and do a roundup of the weekend sports action. And once again, the Patriots, not quite up to the task.
For the win from 31, Crosby right down the middle.
And the 101,000 people in Green Bay breathe with a sigh of relief. You have a third-string rookie quarterback, and you almost get upended. Got to give the Patriots credit for a great plan. But in the end, Aaron Rodgers and the Packers are too much.
And I'm going to say right now, in all fairness, you know, they were playing with a third-string quarterback. We're going to talk about that. Got to do you a little bit, Homer. So with us, after the Patriots fell to the Green Bay Packers, Chris Siderick from WBUR and Jonathan Marshall, who's the sports reporter at WMUR. Jonathan, welcome back.
Good morning, guys. How's it going?
We're doing all right. I know you're not a homer, though, but Chris Siderick is. How you doing today, Chris?
Yeah, I'm more, I'm all right. We're here. Yeah. We're here.
All right. So we heard it in the clip. This is the story here, right? So the Patriots went into the game without first-string quarterback Mac Jones. We're going to talk about that later. Then you get Brian Hoyer, who winds up with a head injury just a few minutes into the game. And then along comes the third string quarterback, Bailey Zappe. And is that not the greatest name ever, Jonathan? So there's drama here and maybe no reason to believe that the Patriots can beat the Packers with a Bailey Zappe debut. Jonathan.
I mean, considering the situation, considering everything that we've talked about, even leading up to this last week with the offensive coordinator situation, the lack of weapons, and Bailey Zappe being the third stringer, a fourth-round rookie, being put in a situation in Lambeau Field, Aaron Rodgers, a Hall of Fame quarterback, one of the best to ever do it, is on the other side. He did pretty well. I mean, I know you don't want to talk about moral victories, right? But I think
these days, I think we'll take moral victories, Jonathan.
if you're a Patriots fan, I think you gotta be at peace with reality, with what this team is this season, and this is what this team is. These moral victories have to be a part of your thinking now. I mean, that's just where it's at right now. These aren't the glory years, right? And so I think yesterday was a positive sign. Ramondre Stevenson, Damian Harris, they had a good game rushing. Devontae Parker, he had a touchdown, so things are opening up more for him. So there was some positive signs offensively for this team. But you look up at the standings, you guys are behind the Jets in the AFC East.
So down.
That's pretty rough.
So, Chris, I'm so glad that Jonathan brought up Lambeau Field, because for people who are not hardcore football fans, they don't give the context of this game.
I mean, you could hear it. Bailey Zappe comes in towards the end of the first half. They've got the ball backed up against their end zone.
This is in Green Bay.
He can't retreat. And that crowd was rocking. I felt bad for the kid, because that is a tough spot to take your first snaps as an NFL quarterback. I do think it's important to point out, as Jonathan says, we were talking a couple weeks ago when the Patriots beat the Steelers. When is a win not a win? This kind of feels like maybe this was a loss that wasn't really a loss, because I think there were some positive things here. And I have to say, as a New England Patriots fan, I don't know about anybody else, but when I see this unheralded rookie quarterback come in because of an injury off the sideline, it's hard for part of your brain not to go, oh, is this the moment we're going to think about 20 years from now? Is this the Bailey Zappe era? I mean, obviously, there's a long way to go before that, but I was pretty happy to see what we saw out of that team. I thought they competed. I thought Zappe kind of rallied in the second half. You could see he got his feet under him a little bit. They moved the ball a little bit. They scored some points. Aaron Rodgers, say what you will about him off the field, but, you know, he's one of the best quarterbacks to play the game too. And so to go toe to toe with him. I thought the kid did all right.
All right, so a couple of things there just to clarify. One, Aaron Rodgers, quarterback of the Green Bay Packers, very controversial on the political front, sort of outside the world of football. Number two, Lambeau Field, kind of like, I'm going to overstate it, but like the Westeros or Westeros, depending on how you pronounce it, right, of football stadiums. So, Jonathan, I'll come back to you, too, because, of course, Chris is making reference to the fact that in 2001, Tom Brady, you know, sort of third-string quarterback, comes in and winds up winning the Super Bowl and becoming, well, you know, Tom Brady. Maybe people hoping this will happen from the Bailey Zappi. Here's what I want to ask you, because we're helping our listeners follow this season. You said at the beginning, your big question about the Patriots is identity. Would we be a passing team? Would we be a running team? Who would we be? Okay, we're down to the third quarterback now. Can we find and keep an identity, Jonathan, if this is where we are?
I think the identity started to show itself last week, right? I think the running game is going to be so crucial. And we saw some of that yesterday, which if you're going to be playing with a third string quarterback, you want to have your running backs, definitely the offensive line, that has to be shored up, right? And so defensively, they stepped up as well. Jack Jones, another rookie, had a pick six. He had a forced fumble. And so I think tough running, tough defense, being sound fundamentally, these have always been Bill Belichick, this part of his coaching, right, and his style. And so I think that identity is something that can withstand the rest of the season. And despite this team being 1-3, I have to say, honestly, there's never been a point to where these guys aren't playing hard, right? And so I feel like 1-3 is 1-3, right? But there are positive signs. I feel like this team does play hard defensively. They have some guys on that side of the ball who will compete. The running game is strong. It's just got to get the quarterback situation. You got to get Mac healthy.
People forget, too, John, before Brady was Brady, those first three Super Bowls that this team won were based on the defense. Their defense would be one of the strongest in the league and would really kind of carry the offense. And so would we love to see that kind of culture built around this young defense? I think it's a great place to start.
So we're we're talking with Jonathan Marshall, WMUR sports reporter, right there. You just heard Chris Sidorek here at WBUR. It's our Monday sports wrap up. We've got a bigger subject we're going to talk about in a little bit that has to do with injuries, et cetera. Just to close out on the Patriots right here, Mac Jones hurts his back in the first game. Gets an ankle injury that keeps him out. Now you've got Brian Hoyer, who filled in for Mac Jones because he was out. He gets a brain injury, looks like a head injury. Do we think we are looking at Bailey Zappi, Jonathan, for a couple of more games? Do we know?
We're not sure yet. With Mac's high ankle sprain, you never know how that may go, right? I know he was on the practice field last week, but he barely could move. And so I think he's going to give it his best shot to try and go, but if he can't, it'd be hard to imagine that they don't give Bailey Zappi another shot, because he played pretty well given the circumstance. And so if he gets a full week of preparation and practice, that will better suit him as well. With Brian Hoyer, with the head injury and, you know, everything that's going on around the league, I don't see them even putting Hoyer back out there, you know, the following week. I just can't see that happen.
Yeah,
so
if Mac's
not ready
to go,
yeah, Zappi, yeah.
Yeah, the NFL is an optics-obsessed league, mm-hmm. right? They are very tapped into kind of what the public is talking about, and that's really what makes them take action, is when there's enough public pressure. And with all the focus, and I know we're going to turn to this in a sec here, on head injuries right now, I'd be shocked if Brian Hoyer comes back next week.
All right, so we will turn to that now, and I'm just going to flag, because we do these sports roundups on Mondays, the Red Sox played over the weekend. They're pretty much done. But the Celtics played over the weekend, too. And in the next couple of weeks, we're going to be able to move on from just Patriots and pick up some of these other Boston sports teams as well. But for now, Jonathan Marshall, Chris Sidorek, stick tight. We are going to add another voice here, but let me set this up, okay? The NFL faced some public pressure after last Thursday night's game. Okay, so folks, Miami Dolphins quarterback Tua Tagovailoa went down after a scary head injury, and his arms and fingers seemed to be locked in place in a thing called fencing. It was really scary, and it reminded us a lot about the stakes of the game. Here is former NFL coach Rex Ryan on ESPN's Sunday NFL Countdown.
I treated every one of my players like they were my son. And that's all you have to do. And I can tell you this, all right? Would you put your son back in that game when you saw it? Forget this back and ankle BS that we heard about. This is clearly from head trauma. That's it, a concussion. I know what it looks like. We all know what it looks like, all right? My answer is this. No way in hell I put my son back in that game. No way in hell. And you know what? No way in hell I put somebody else's son back out there either.
And he's referring to a previous game where Tagovailoa appeared to have a head injury, was put back in the game under the claim that it was actually his back. All right, so listen, as that started to unfold, I just kept thinking about Boston Globe associate editor and columnist Renee Graham, who told us a few years ago that she had stopped watching football over exactly this. So we just talked a ton about football, but now we're going to talk about whether we should be. And Renee Graham, welcome back. Thanks for joining Jonathan and Chris and me.
Thank you.
Are you kind of, so just to point out, you actually used to be part of our annual post-Super Bowl panel until you decided to stop watching football. And a lot of that was over the bodies and the harm of players, correct?
You know, I grew up a hardcore football fan. You know, I still have the football cards I bought as a kid. I was a Giants fan. Sorry, y'all. But, you know, it just hit a point for me in 2018. It was really two factors. One was the queasiness of what was happening to these players. The other part was what happened with Colin Kaepernick and being deprived of his livelihood because of his protests against racial injustice. But even before that, I'd been feeling really, as I said, queasy about essentially watching rich men slowly killing themselves for wealthy men. And I couldn't quite get around that. And I remember when Junior Seau died by suicide, and there was this announcement that he had never been diagnosed with a concussion. He played for 20 years as a linebacker. We know he had to have had concussions, but this is how corrupt the league was, that he was never diagnosed with concussions. And so seeing what happened again with Tagovailoa, it just sort of brought me back to the idea of why I simply can't watch football anymore.
So, Jonathan, when we start this conversation, right, you and Chris and I, we just spent several minutes talking football. We all watched football yesterday, and I'm capable of being haunted by both of those things. As a sports reporter, how do you think about a moment like this and what accountability is and needs to be for the NFL? And I don't want to lose the fact that, you know, we had Patriots quarterback Mac Jones, a young guy with a back injury and then an ankle injury, and the coach continuously saying, oh, well, maybe he'll be back this weekend, with a back injury and an ankle injury, Jonathan.
Yeah, it's really scary, and everything that Renee is saying is on point. I don't have to be an expert, right, to see what happened to Tua Tagovailoa last week against Buffalo and seeing him walking off the field hobbling and almost falling to the ground and having to be helped off by his teammates only to be brushed off as a back or a neck injury. You know, it's just ridiculous. And I don't know how you can see that and be okay with allowing a guy to get back out there. Not just a few days later, right? That happened on Sunday and they're playing on Thursday night football. It's just amazing to me. And I think when these things happen, I look at myself, I look at the media, how are we covering these things? And the injury happened. It was scary, but what? The game goes on, right? We're still watching it. Fans are still watching it. And so the eyes are still on there. The coverage is still on these games. So the NFL is still winning, right? Like what's the consequence for the league? You know what I mean?
Yeah, you're talking about an industry that's, you know, tens of billions of dollars a year in national revenue, never mind what the individual teams make. And I think the money is what talks, right? The NFL is going to do what they're going to do while they're making the money. And it is nauseating. I hated seeing the video of that. And you hear, you played Rex Ryan at the top there, Tiziana. You hear the passion in his voice. That's just not the same perspective that a lot of coaches and a lot of organizations have. And I think it points to the fact that the NFL is now scrambling to try to change these rules and adjust their concussion protocol. But ultimately, the team doctors are still the ones that get final say about the player coming back into the game. And I don't know how you can sit here and say that a team doctor employed by a franchise is going to be objective about something like that when clearly they have a vested interest and it's not the health of the player.
Exactly.
So, Renee, jump in further, and I'll say we reached out to our listeners through our texting group, and we got so many responses back. And one thing that strikes me is one of our texters compared the language here, you know, to owners and people who are owned. And you talked about rich men playing for wealthy men and that concept of ownership. I'd like to invite you to dive into that a little bit further, Renee.
Well, you know, It's exactly what Chris was just saying and exactly what Jonathan was just saying. He went down in that Thursday night game And, you know, you could hear the hush in the crowd. You could see the players around him. And then they wheeled him off on a stretcher and the game went on. Because it's about the money. You know, what the NFL has right now is a PR issue. They don't see this as an issue of player health and safety, because if they did, there wouldn't even be a Thursday night game.
Why? How say some more about that. Because of the lack of downtime between two games for the body to recover?
You know, even if you don't have a concussion, and we know that there are far more concussions than ever get reported by league officials, you can't have someone who has a concussion on Sunday coming back and playing on a Thursday 4 days later. I got a concussion as a kid, and I didn't feel right for weeks. And it was an accident, and I wasn't going back to the same thing I had been doing that I got the concussion, but it, you know, it was a collision during a softball game and I didn't play that whole time, but I didn't feel right. And no one could have told me differently. So the idea that a player could be injured the way that he was, and let's face it, let's just say it, the Miami Dolphins lied last Sunday that it was a back injury. It was clearly not a back injury, but there is so much money at stake. There's no way that they're not going to put their best quarterback back on the field, even when his health is at risk and he has clearly been compromised by a hit to the head. The, you know, the NFL can talk about protocols all it wants, but the only protocol it understands is profit.
So Jonathan Marshall from WMUR, will there be consequences for the Dolphins? Renee just pointed out it really does look like they lied.
Well, the NFL said there was an investigation, but we haven't heard anything about that. I think there was an independent doctor that has since been, you know, removed from his duties. But as far as the Dolphins as an organization, we'll wait and see what the NFL does. But like we've been saying, money talks, right? And so that's the bottom line. And, you know, even outside of the concussion situation, what these guys put their bodies through, I mean, Justin Herbert, the quarterback for the LA Chargers, fractured his rib. And he was playing a few days later, the following week. Mm. They said, we're just going to inject his ribs. We don't know what they're injecting his ribs with, but he's back out there, right? Clearly cannot throw without feeling pain. So it's so deeper, so much deeper in this league and what these guys are putting their bodies through. And it's not normal, and it's definitely not healthy. You got to look at the long-term impacts of these guys' lives. I mean, because football is a short time, right? These guys have to live the rest of their lives through these physical pains, these mental pains. And so we're not looking at that. The NFL isn't looking at that.
I think it's worth reminding folks too, Jonathan, this is the league that suspended Ray Rice for 2 games until the video of the domestic abuse incident came out. They only care about public pressure. It's not about what's right. It's not about protecting the players. And I think it's important to remember that for sure.
Well, I appreciate us diving in. Renee, wait, you have 2 sentences. Go.
Yeah, part of the public pressure has to also come from the fans. If people continue to watch the games, then the NFL learns nothing.
All right, that is Renee Graham, associate editor and columnist for the Boston Globe. We've also had WMUR sports reporter Jonathan Marshall and WBUR's Chris Siderick. Thanks to all three of you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So listeners, just a note, October 19th, Meghna Chakrabarty will moderate a discussion on CTE and concussions with BU CTE researcher Dr. Jesse Mez and two-time Olympic gold medalist and World Cup champion Brianna Scurry at WBUR City Space. You can find more information about that on our website at radioboston.org. And that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.